You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Howard Bryant's new book, The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism, couldn't be more timely. First and foremost, because it's critical that we always examine our history, the prevalence of racism, and the forces at play that contribute to it, but also because of the national conversation unfolding within the NFLA right now, and because 2018 is the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Olympics. That history-defining Olympics when two black athletes, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, upon receiving their gold and bronze medals, raised their fist in solidarity as a call for recognition of the injustice experienced within their community. Their action reverberated around the world and was met with great consequence for them personally, their careers, their families. And yet it is that history, this history, and those of other seminal figures like Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali, and Paul Robeson, that author Howard Bryant spotlights in his book, that set the foundation for the athlete activist we hear about today. And tonight we have the tremendous honor of hosting one such person, Dr. John Carlos, as part of our conversation. And although the spotlight has been focused very recently on athletes like LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick, their voices follow a legacy, one that has always come with a heavy cost. Woven into this narrative are the entangling histories of 9/11 and Ferguson, two recent sociopolitical moments that became turning points in this story, and how capitalism and the military-industrial complex also play a heavy hand in the politics of patriotism. Howard Bryant is also the author of Shutout, A Story of Race and Baseball in Boston, which was a finalist for the Society of American Baseball's Research 2003 Seymour Medal, and Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. He is a senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, appears regularly on ESPN's The Sports Reporters, and serves as a sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Dr. John Carlos is a medaled USA track and field Hall of Fame athlete and Olympian, an alumni of San Jose State University. His gesture at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City upon accepting the bronze medal was captured in a photograph that was shared worldwide and has become arguably one of the most iconic images of the 21st century. His action was condemned by the International Olympic Committee, who suspended Carlos and his teammate, Tommy Smith, from the U.S. team. Since then, Carlos went on to play in the NFL and has been a counselor, supervisor, and track and field coach at Palm Springs High School. Together with Offa Dave Zirin, he authored the book, The John Carlos Story, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. He was honored in 2016 at the White House by President Obama. And Dr. Carlos is arguably the world's fastest humanitarian. And leading him and Howard Bryant in conversation is Dr. Todd Boyd, who holds the Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture and Professor of Cinema and Media Studies at the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts. Boyd is a media commentator, author, and scholar, and through his pioneering work in many disciplines, among them film, music, television, and sports, transcends boundaries. He is recognized as a distinctively authoritative voice on the role of culture in American society, and you very may well have heard him or read his work at ESPN.com, the NFL Network, the LA Times, or KCRW in conversations about the politics of patriotism. So please join me now in welcoming our distinguished guests to the Aloud stage at the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you, Marlene. Thank you.
Okay. Good greeting you, brother.
Oh, man. Good greeting. I'm going to sit down.
Thank you for such a warm greeting. And of course, the numerous clenched black fists that we saw raised as Dr. John Carlos led us out this evening. We're hoping to have, and I'm sure we will, a very engaged conversation around a topic that is always timely, but is especially timely in the present moment. Dr. John Carlos, as well as Howard Bryant, the author of The Heritage, and I want to talk about the sort of history of black athletes, patriotism, politics and sports, and a number of other topics that this applies to over the time we have allotted to us this evening. So, gentlemen, I thought what we would do, because it was interesting to me to begin, is to talk about the fact that there is this phrase, a phrase that used to be really common that has sort of died out in previous, in contemporary generations, but this idea of the black athlete. And the reason I mention that is because when we talk about sports in contemporary society, black athletes have dominated so many sports for so many years that it's to a point when people say athlete, it's almost assumed now that the athlete is black. This was not always the case. And so when we go back and we look at this history, to me, from the very beginning, I start with Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson was incredibly political and in many ways set a tone that Dr. John Carlos and others would pick up again in the 1960s. So perhaps, Dr. Carlos, if you would, maybe you can get us started by talking about your experience in Mexico City, the image, the clenched black fist that has become an iconic figure, and I think clearly one of the most popular photos of the 20th century that has really etched your name and your likeness in legendary status and has kept it there for quite some time. So if you could maybe begin by sharing with us some of your thoughts on that and how those things have played out over the course of your life.
All right. First of all, it's great to be here with you guys this evening and share. I started out in Harlem, New York as a young kid, wide-eyed, trying to find my niche in society. As a youngster, I didn't go with the guys my age or the girls my age. I was more hanging out with the older individuals, trying to question them, trying to fill the voice in my mind. And I noticed something at a very early age in Harlem. It was a thing called white flight. And it just looked like they had a meeting that night. We rolling up out of here. That next morning, they was packing up the station wagons and the trucks, and they were gone. And I remember saying to my father, say, Pop, where they going? Why are they leaving? He said, son, I don't know where they going. He said, but I would suggest that they're leaving because they don't like the fact that the domesticated workers are now their next-door neighbors. So when they left, I began to realize that when they left, law enforcement had a nasty attitude towards the people that lived in that neighborhood. For instance, like if the kids was on the stoop, the police would come by and say, well, I go around the corner and come back, you better be gone. And I remember some of my partners would get up and leave, and I would sit there, and he'd come back, and the cop, excuse my expression, the Irish cop would say, kid, what do you want? Kid, you want a boot in the ass? Kid, I tell you to move on. And I looked at him, I said, man, I live here. I'm not going anywhere. But I looked at my friends in terms of how they were, they felt intimidated, whether they lived there or not. The cops say, move, you're supposed to move. But then I began to realize it wasn't just those kids. It was a race of people. I looked at certain things, which I was trying to express to you earlier today, about when I was a kid, I saw a horse and a buggy, you know, one for the Iceman, another one for the produce man. And I remember my brothers and they said, man, let's go get some of them oranges. I wasn't concerned about snatching oranges as much as I was concerned about the horse. And my brother would say, man, why are you fixated about that horse? And I looked at him, I told him, I said, man, it looked like they training the horse. And he said, what do you mean they training? I said, what's that thing on his eyes? They had these blinders where the horse couldn't look and say, man, the sun is over there and it's raining over to the right. I'm going to the left. All he could see was straight ahead. I took those blinders and interpreted that that's what they were doing to people of color in the United States. They don't want you to think for yourself as to where you should go, what you would want to do. And at the same time, while I'm realizing this, I say I went to a school named after a guy by the name of Frederick Douglass. I didn't know who Frederick Douglass was, but when I found out that he was a black man, now I have a concern, an interest. But in that same interest, I wanted to be concerned about why there was no pictures of Frederick Douglass in the school. They didn't want me to see that he looked like me. Then I began to realize that, hey, we're here in terms of numbers. We're not here in terms of education because they tell us that we're not qualified to go to college. I remember looking at black men that they went to drugs. And I remember when the drug epidemic hit Harlem, because before the drugs hit, it was a thing called King Kong, bootleg liquor. That was like modern day PCP. They drink it, they think they can fly straight to their death. Well, they went to sleep one night, just as the white flight, heroin came into the neighborhood. So many fathers looked into that mirror and began not to like themselves. Sit back and think about a black man looking in the mirror and say, I don't like me. Why? Because I can't be the father for my kids. Because I can't be the husband to my wife. Because I can't be the breadwinner. Because I can't do anything. Now I start disguising, making my wife think I'm going to look for a job when I know there's no job out there. So I go out and fake it like I'm looking for a job. Now I wake up one day and I look in the mirror, and I'm not just merely going through the change of washing my face or brushing my hair. I'm looking in the mirror at me and realize that I don't like myself. Well, I saw these things and I saw the junkies and I asked them, why are you shooting up? Junkie told me, man, you really want to know, Johnny? I said, I keep asking. He said, man, do you know what it's like to have a girl that you fell in love with in school and you got up the courage to ask her to be your girl? Then you got even more courage to ask her to be your wife and you want to be the best husband in the world? And you find out that someone, something is holding you back? I'm looking for escapism. Just like you guys saw that movie a few years back, Lady Sings the Blues, Billie Holiday. Remember when Billie was on the bus and she saw them guys hiding in the hoods? And they went back and they said to her, I said, Billy, we got to get the day's work tomorrow night. Here, take this little package. It'll help you. Well, those black men took that package thinking it was a weekend trip. Well, that weekend trip turned into 70 years. So when you think about John Collins 50 years ago going to the Olympic Games and making a statement, I thought about all those fathers that was missing in action that went to the drugs and never came back home. So our black kids are raising themselves. The boombox is raising them. The drug dealers are raising them. The radio, the television is raising them. So someone had to be this what do you call it, lighthouse. Someone had to be the town crier. And I looked at my partners, and I saw the same fear in their eyes that I saw when I was a kid. But the only way you're going to crack fear, man, is to say, let's set a new paradigm. Let them see something that they never seen before. It took guts to do it. Because in your household, your mom don't understand what you're doing. Your dad don't understand what you're doing. And then you have a concern about they are worried about your safety. I used to tell my mother, I said, Mom, don't worry about me dying. I said, because when God want me to go, I'm ready to go. I said, but don't have no fear about death because we all going to die. I would prefer to die standing for something that I believe in than to die and know that I did nothing to help individuals in this society. So as, hey guys, do me a favor. I had to say this. Don't applaud for me. And we got security in the building too. If you applaud, we're going to run you out of here. And the reason why I say don't applaud for me is because I'm not here, you know, doing a soft shoe dance. I'm not here singing. I'm here trying to deliver a message and hope that I can make a connection with somebody in the building. I'm not looking for applause. I'm not looking for trophies. But I always say, if you feel like you must do something, you want to throw a jingle up here, I'll accept that. So where did I leave off? I was getting ready to close it out. I'm trying. Where did I leave off? Tell me, help me. Huh? Oh, the lighthouse. Yeah, so this beacon, you want to be a beacon for society. And then God told me that I had an ability. Now, my ability was like Robin Hood as a kid. I looked at Robin Hood on TV. That was my hero then. He's my hero today. Because Robin Hood wasn't concerned about the sheriff of Nottingham. He wasn't about the king. He was concerned about those that came through Nottingham Forest to make them pay a tariff. Because all the people was being pillaged by the king and the sheriff. So I saw the freight trains coming up in front of the Yankee Stadium. Because when the drugs hit Harlem, there was an exodus of food. There was no food in the cabinets. There was no clothes in the closets. And I saw these freight trains coming by, and I said, man, if they coming by, I'm going to investigate and see what it was. And when I saw they had frozen food in there, so succotash and all that kind of stuff, clothes, I took it to people in the neighborhood and give it to them and tell them, say, whatever you do, don't tell my father. Because my father's all American and didn't believe in breaking the law or none of that. But then I had to make my parents realize that there's two laws. It's man's law, and then there's God's law. God's law was trumped by man's law. Man's law kicked God's law up under the bus. So I decided to break in. Two black detectives out of 32nd Precinct in New York knew who I was because they would chase. They'd catch my buddies, but they could never catch me. But they can catch you with their eyes. And they went to my father and said, Earl, there's been some break-ins at the freight yards, and you need to tell Johnny. My father stopped them. He said, that's your job. You need to tell him. And they came to me, and Mr. Lester was about maybe 5'11", 6 feet. Mr. Bryan was like 6'6", 6'7", big red bone. And he looked at Mr. Bryan, Mr. Lester, and he said, go on, tell him. And Mr. Lester said, you have a talent. But I want you to know there's been some break-ins in the freight trains, and we think we know who's doing it. We can't do anything to him until we catch him, and we're going to catch him. And he took his nose and pushed my nose up against mine when he said that. And Mr. Bryan said, tell him the other thing. And he says, you have a talent. What talent? You're a runner. I smirked. Mr. Bryan smacked me. Don't you ever disrespect Mr. Lester. That's how I got started in track and field. Now, when I got started in track and field, now I realize that I have this gift. But the question is, based on this beacon or this lighthouse I was telling you about, I had to perfect my game to be the best that I could possibly be. In order to be able to be that shining knight for those that have no hope. God put me in situations where I met Dr. King. Dr. King taught me something in terms of, when I asked him, I said, why are you going back to Memphis if they threaten your life? He said, John, I'm going back to stand for those that won't stand for themselves. And John, I'm going back to Memphis to stand for those that can't stand for themselves. When he said that, my life went full circle because that's exactly what I've been doing all my life. But I never had a title for it. Everybody can have an imagination. If you just slow down and say, let me look at the good things in life opposed to the bad things. My good things were to see so many smiling faces. And I sit back and I think about people of color and think about how many guys that's impotent right now, or how many guys that's losing their hair right now, or how many of them have heart disease. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying it to be funny. I'm saying it to make a point. And the point is this. Every time I see a black kid get gunned down in the street, every time I see the police shoot somebody, every time I see a gang member shoot somebody else, I say, man, that's a cure for heart disease right there. That's a cure for cancer right there. That's gone, leaving this world because we as human beings haven't come together to have an understanding about love, understanding, and affection for one another. And I'm going to leave it alone. You can go on with the rest. Hey, oh, watch it.
Howard, you've written a book with the title The Heritage, and I thought it would be good maybe for you to begin by sort of explaining to us this brilliant concept about the heritage and how it pertains to sort of black athletes and politics over time.
Absolutely. Well, I am grateful to be here more than anything else. Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Carlos, for sitting with us as well. And I felt that I'm actually reading Zora Neale Hurston's book, Batacoon, right now, which is absolutely heartbreaking and tremendous and amazing. And Alice Walker did the introduction, and she had a line in there that talked about those who are duty-bound to the ancestors to work for them. And just to be here on Juneteenth just means a lot to me. So, okay, I said that.
Respect.
So now, to me, the heritage is, it's just a term that actually came from interviews. It's not anything that I was aware of. It was actually something that took place when the publisher, Beacon Press, who's been fantastic, they didn't love the titles of the book, and they were asking me, is there a phrase that kept coming through? And so whether you were talking to Dusty Baker or whether you were going back and talking to any of the players that you'd spoken with in the past or talking to activists, everyone kept talking about this inheritance, this heritage of ours that goes back, and whether you go back to Jack Johnson or you start with Robeson or you go to Jesse Owens and then to Jackie and further on, right, and then to Smith Carlos, etc. You keep going, and there's a line here. There's a line through this, and then there's a line where it stopped that we talked about over dinner, right, we'll get into. There's a line where it stopped, and then there's a line where it came back,
right,
in 2012 when LeBron stepped up after Trayvon Martin was killed.
Right.
And so you started to wonder what happened to that line, what happened to that heritage. And to me, what it really was about your responsibility. The argument that I make in the book is that the black athlete is the most important, most influential, and most visible black employee this country's ever produced. And when you think about it, you're the ones who integrated the culture before the military, before the schools,
right,
before the hospitals,
right,
before everything. You're the ones who made it. And being the ones who made it came with a responsibility. Whether you like it or not, no matter what we talk about, no matter all the championships, what do we still say about Michael Jordan? Where was he for the community?
Right.
You talk about Tiger Woods, for all the majors, all 14 of them, what are we still? There's still a little asterisk there.
Right.
And so this is a responsibility that you can't escape from whether you want to or not. And what's actually really interesting to me about it is it's happening at a time when people are telling you to shut up and dribble, when people are telling you to stick to sports, when people are telling you that they elected a president who, by dint of you talking, questions your citizenship, your fitness to be here. And they're targeting you, the black athlete, specifically. Because when we look at somebody like Oprah, or if you look at someone like Mark Cuban, or if you look at all of these rich people, Donald Trump, Michael Bloomberg, Richard Reardon, they got what they got because they had money. We listen to the people who have money. And the ones who have money, they get to speak more, except for this player, this athlete.
Right.
For that athlete, we say, no, 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 you'd be grateful. What are you complaining about? So to me, I was just fascinated by that story. I was fascinated by that line from where you brought us. I was fascinated by where it went. And now I'm fascinated that it's back, at least. And we get to go forward.
I think on that, I've often thought, I've talked about this a lot. Dr. Carlos sort of came to prominence in the 1960s, which is, of course, the decade of Muhammad Ali, yourself, Kurt Flood, Jim Brown, Kareem, long list of people. And it bleeds through the 1970s, up into the 80s and 90s. And then, of course, just to contextualize this, you have the emergence of Michael Jordan. And there's this famous, infamous moment in the early 90s. I assume everybody knows this, but then I realize I'm getting older and things I assume everybody know, they don't necessarily know. But this is one of the results of it. So because of that, I need to sort of explain what it is, because this gives us the context. So in the early 1990s, Michael Jordan, a native of North Carolina, was asked by the campaign of a cat named Harvey Gantt, the mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina, if he would be willing to endorse Mr. Gantt, who was running against one of the worst humans to ever breathe, a guy by the name of Jesse Helms, otherwise known as Senator No. And Jordan said, or supposedly said, it was assumed he said it, Sam Smith said he said it to him, something along the lines of Republicans buy Nikes.
Buy shoes, too.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Shoes,
Nikes. Excuse me.
It's become urban legend over this time. This is a new generation. The money that guys like Michael Jordan was able to make in the 80s and 90s was very different than what went on, of course, in the 1960s and 70s. Now, when people say to me, Jordan was not political, I'm like, no, that was actually a very political statement he made. It was not a liberal political statement, but it was very political because what he said was money is, in essence, more important to me than lending my fame and visibility to help defeat a racist senator from my home state. But because Jordan was so visible and so popular and so successful, a lot of other athletes of that time and immediately following him embraced that same philosophy. I'm not going to say anything. The 1992 LA riots, it was amazing to me how people tripped over each other trying not to say anything about what was going on with the riots. But then, as you mentioned, Howard, in the last, what, 5 or 6 years, we have now seen a new generation, LeBron, Colin Kaepernick, et cetera. There's others we can add to the list. It's interesting to think about that 50-year transition because a lot of people have become visible and made a lot of money. The circumstances are different in one sense, but every time I see a certain individual on television these days, I hear Richard Nixon in one ear and George Wallace in the other. So as much as we think things have changed, what's really changed? So this context I apply is this long history. This is the heritage. This is the line we can draw from Dr. John Carlos to the present generation. But when we draw that line, we have to jump over
take a little break.
That generation.
We have to take a break. Well, and it's funny because I talked to a lot of people for this book, and what I found really interesting about it was this deal that you're talking about. What's the cost of this? What are we really talking about? And what we're really talking about is the connection to your blackness. That's what we're really talking about. What we're talking about is Michael Jordan and a lot of those players, and we've seen it up until now, were making a calculated decision that if you stood for your people, you were costing yourself money and status and employment opportunities and all of these things. And so to me, I think what's different is that I think you have to go back to even Ali. I think probably Ali's mid-70s was the last time the best of the best player tied his public persona to his race as well. That this was a part of me. I'm not letting this go. I'm not going to amputate this part of me. And that amputation is what we're asking. Because we, for some reason, don't want this athlete to have both. We don't want them to connect to where they came from. And so what I really sort of liked about this was that there is no way around it. There's a collision taking place right now. And what's interesting about this collision is that in your time, team sports essentially viewed politics. They didn't want anything to do with it on either side because it was bad for business. You were going to upset one side or the other. But today, post 9/11, politics is good for business. Patriotism is good for business. Militarization is good for business. And that is colliding at a time now when you've got black athletes, especially post-Ferguson, who have decided to return to this. No, I've talked to athletes all the time. I talked to a couple of guys from the St. Louis Rams when they came out with the hands up, don't shoot in 2014. And Tavon Austin, one of the wide receivers, was saying, I can't go home when people look at me and say, well, how come you didn't say anything? Right. Especially when you had young people out here blocking LAX. You had people really standing up in the street. And I remember talking to Carmelo Anthony about this after a Baltimore with Freddie Gray. And he was saying, I'm going home. And I just thought it was fascinating to actually see an athlete walking arm in arm in the street. Hadn't seen that in years. Now that, you know, you send a check on the back, you know, down the back channels, you send a check to an HBCU and now we're good. Right. That's what it used to be. And so that break in between, I think it's also one of the reasons why people are so surprised now when you look and see LeBron James or you see these athletes actually speaking, because if you're of a given generation, if you're of my generation, you remember this. But if you're from a different generation, if you're from the next generation, you are completely unused to seeing an athlete actually say something.
And so it seems really unusual, yeah.
Yeah, like I was saying, it's a blueprint. You know, my understanding 50 years ago is that many athletes, as well as general everyday grassroots people, had a fear factor. I have a concern about if I make a statement, well, I'm going to be able to go to work tomorrow. I have a concern about the fact that my oppressor might not like me. He might get upset because I asked him to take his foot off my neck. I'm afraid. I mean, many individuals stepped away from me after the demonstration, individuals that I grew up with that I love today as much as I love that day. But when came time someone broke out a camera to take a picture, oh, you would think somebody put some raid down the way they would run.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't you write it?
Let me get away from you because I do not want to be in the picture.
Well, didn't you say in your book, you said something about all the people who had posters of me and told me I was an inspiration and didn't talk to me.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I sit back and I think, I said, what's the difference today than 50 years ago? Now, I say 50 years ago, I had a quest. I saw something wrong, and I wanted to try and fix it the best way I knew how. I didn't have, at that time, $5 in my bank account. I had a wife. I had two kids. I didn't have $5. But I wasn't concerned about the money that I didn't have as much as I was concerned about the money that my kids are supposed to have opportunities to make later. So I had to make a statement. I was compelled to make a statement. And then you sit back and you say, now here we are 50 years later and we have a young man to say he's a professional athlete. Where I said I didn't have $5 in my bank account, he might have $5 million in his bank account today. So it goes to show you it wasn't about his economic wealth is why Mr. Kaepernick chose to step up and say, I'm going to take a knee or I'm going to take a seat. It wasn't about the fact that he had $5 million in his pocket and he might lose that $5 million. He's concerned about the same issue that I was concerned about with $5. But the end result was so many people stepped away from him the same way they stepped away from me 50 years ago. But the good side is that 50 years ago, we had a small nucleus of individuals that was involved in the Olympic Project for Human Rights. 50 years later, those numbers have grown. We have LeBron James. We have Chris Paul. We have Curry. We have many key components in the athletic world. We have many key components in the entertainment field that stand now and say, man, I don't have the fear factor anymore. And why they think that I don't have the fear factor is because they realize that what I'm doing today, man, they might not really understand and want to jump on board, but another 10, 15 years, a lot of people going to understand and start to cross the road and try and make this a better society. Now, if you sit back and you think about we as people, we are appalled that Kaepernick would take a knee, but we wasn't appalled that the president would call them sons of bitches. Everybody in America sat back, oh, it's cool because it's the president saying that. We sat back when the president went and said, oh, those people downtown, down in the South with them hoods on, they're good people too. We sat back and we allowed him to say that. So my question to you is, what the hell is wrong with you? Because as much as I spoke up as a young man at 23 years old with a wife and two kids, I spoke up. When are you going to speak up? You can't come here and listen to us sit up and tell you about what it was like and what we're fighting to make change. It's not my fight. This is our fight. If I'm doing my part, don't come here and yippee-ki-yay me and applaud me and give me whistles and pat me on the back. You did a great job. Because my question is, what the hell are you doing? You feel me? Hey, sister, you might protest. But take some time next time and look around and see how many of you there are. You understand? Because a lot of people, as Mr. Howard said, a lot of people talk a good game. But when it comes time for action, everybody's dormant.
Well, it's funny because we talk about this. I always say that this heritage is not a club you want to join.
Right.
It's a club that is called to you to join.
That's right.
And when you think about it, in fact, Cap and I talked about this last year. If you think about this, they all got destroyed, or they all tried to destroy them. Paul Robeson got destroyed. We love Jackie Robinson. We named the freeway after him over in Brooklyn, right? He's on a stamp. You name schools after him. Major League Baseball did not offer Jackie Robinson a job after he retired. Nothing until the day he died. We know what happened to Curt Flood when he challenged the economic system in baseball. We see what's happening with Colin Kaepernick now. We saw what happened to Abdul Mahmoud Arouf. We see what happens in Craig Hodges. You see what happens. And so it's not something that you're going to get patted on the back for. And I think there's something else, too, and you were just talking about this, and we were talking about this earlier, this idea today, do you get to join this heritage simply by wearing a T-shirt that says, I can't breathe? Do you get to join this heritage? Are you in the pantheon of Robeson and Robinson and Ali when you've got Nike producing your commercials for you? Even though Nike is offering all law enforcement a 15% discount when you buy their sneakers. Mm-hmm. So they're having it both ways. And so to me, the challenge today is in some ways even greater because you can play a lot of hocus pocus with the public. I did an event in Boston and somebody stood up and they were talking about Kaepernick and they asked a question, who's gonna be the next Curt Flood in football? Who's gonna be the one who sends that message that enough is enough? And I looked at him and I said, you. The NFL is a $14 billion industry. Right. And they only deal with this. They have one measure, 15 million, 16 million, 20 million. Right. And so are you still using the product? Are you still watching the product? Are you still buying the jerseys? Are you still doing all of this? Are you buying the camouflage jerseys when the Department of Defense is paying to militarize these games before the games, you know, before it all starts?
Let me throw a little light on that. You know, when you sit back and you think about superstar athletes that might go contrary to where my thoughts are. And I got to thinking about that. And I was saying, you know, what I see is man-made icons. Man made these individuals, okay? And they make them to cross up where my thoughts are. But then when I talked earlier about, you know, there's two laws. There's man's law and there's God's law. Well, I haven't met God, but I know somebody's out there in charge. And I know that God has a situation where he made some God-given icons. Now, here's the point. They had a guy named Rock Hudson years ago, and Rock Hudson died. You ain't heard no more about Rock Hudson. But they had a guy named Paul Robeson years ago that did what he did. He died, but you hear about Paul Robeson every month. They had a woman that played Cleopatra. What was her name? Liz Taylor. Liz Taylor died. You don't hear about Liz Taylor, but you hear about Rosa Parks every month. And that's the difference what I'm trying to say. You know, like when you talk about good and bad, up and down, fat and skinny, God takes care of his icon. That's why you cannot suppress these individuals. That's why you sit back and you say, well, the president talking about he going to give Jack Johnson a pardon like Jack Johnson needs a pardon 100 years later.
Yeah, at this point okay? in time. Right.
Well, but that was just them saying, fine, say we're going to bring Jack Johnson to life again.
Well, true. I had this conversation with Reverend Sharpton. We were going back and forth talking about this break in this activism. And you do hear about these people. You don't hear about them for doing this thing. Right. They can still talk about what you did. And I said to him, I said, well, during your time, I said, I know we're talking about Trayvon and we're talking about Ferguson and we're talking about these athletes and Eric Garner and the whole thing. But during your time, when you had the Central Park Five and you had Howard Beach and you had Bensonhurst and you had Yusef Hawkins and Eleanor Bumpers and all those things that took place, where were the athletes then? And he said to me, in the 1980s, not a single athlete reached out to me during all those things that were happening. Not one. He He said, the entertainers, he said, yeah, James Brown would call you and say, look, I got your back. Here's $10,000, even though I don't want any publicity. Prince would call him and send him $20,000. And he said, Michael Jackson would call him, give him some money and say, look, we got you. Public Enemy, the rappers, all those guys, right. KRS-One, Boogie Down Productions, those guys. He said, but no ball players, not one. Mm-hmm. And I had said to him, well, why did you think that was? And of course, one of the things he said was, well, because it's easy to attack Jim Crow. But these guys today, they're corporations, and they own teams, and they're Northern, and now no one wants to challenge that. And I said to him when we were talking about this concept of athlete power and what can we really do, and do you want to get involved in this or not? And I said to him, well, maybe Michael Jordan had it right. And he recognized that in this system, in this culture that we're in, that you're not going to get a seat at the table. You're not going to get revolution because you're only 13% of the population. Maybe getting as much money as you can get is as good as it's going to get.
And that's why I said that was a political statement.
Right.
Yeah. And Sharpton said, maybe, but you're still a coward.
But that's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. You know, more than being a coward, I just think that they're just scared. Out and out. I remember when I was at Wall Street and we was going against the 1%ers. And I'm down there and I'm talking to all the people down there in the park. And I'm looking out in the foyer area and I see so many people walking by. And I begin to look into people's eyes that's walking by. I was there for like 3 days. And I began every day to peer into their eyes and I began to look and see that people wanted to be there so much with us in terms of being in support of what we were fighting for. But I saw that fear factor. Like I fear that my boss might see me on the news. I have fear that I might get cracked across the head with the police. But then in that 3 day span, I seen many people build that courage. Because they heard people speaking on issues that was confronting them on a daily basis.
They build a movement.
They begin to realize that, hey, man, only way we're going to turn things around is when we become one. I'm only as strong as the next link. And they started crossing the line, coming into the park and taking part. That's the only way we're going to make change. I'm not trying to knock 45. But I am trying to educate 45. I'm not trying to knock the KKK, but I'm trying to educate the KKK and let them know. Say, hey, man, let me tell you, I figured out why you wear them sheets. They look at me, what are you talking about? I say, man, I know why you wear the sheets. Because you don't want me to see your face. Not because you don't want me to see your face here on this earth, because you have a reputation for taking lives. But you don't want me to see your face because I have no fear about dying, but wherever I go, I'm going to wait for your ass to come. See, so you put a hood on. Now, tell me about why the KKK wore them hoods all along. Because they was your bankers. They was your druggers.
Right.
They was your educators.
And your police.
They was your doctors. And we know they was the police.
Well, and I was going to say, that is one of the things about this, too, that I
took out. Excuse me, I have to make a run. I have a prostate issue, and I got to deal with it.
We'll take care of it.
I'll be right back.
You got it.
All right.
You know, we were talking earlier. Mm-hmm. This fear factor thing, mm-hmm. And I think I was telling you and Dr. Carlos this story about going to the NFL Network.
Mm-hmm.
The day after Colin Kaepernick decided not to stand for the national anthem, before he took a knee, he simply stayed on the bench. And it's a Saturday, and I get a call from the NFL Network, and they're very frantic. We need you to come in, talk about this Colin Kaepernick thing. I'm like, it's Saturday, and I got shit to do. we need you, right? So I end up at the NFL Network. The thing that was interesting to me, if any of you watch the NFL Network on a regular basis, you know that a lot of the people working at the NFL Network on the air are former NFL players. And NFL players have this reputation, based on the sport, of being some of the toughest individuals in our society. Like, you think of NFL players and you think of, you know, physical, violent, sort of, you know, athletic, like, pursuit. And I'm walking around the NFL network that night, and it was amazing to me, but it wasn't amazing to me, but it was in one sense, in another sense, it was what I expected. And talk about the fear factor. All of these former NFL players were terrified of what Colin Kaepernick deciding not to stand for the national anthem meant to me, meant to them. They were terrified what it meant and what it would mean for their lives, and they were nervous and scared. And I remember thinking, if the public could see this as opposed to what you see on Sunday, the point was that they know how to play football. But this idea that you would actually take a controversial stand that someone might disagree with and in turn criticize you for, they were as scared as you could possibly be. And the contrast between that and what you see when you watch football on Sunday is really fascinating, because it exemplifies there's a lot of people who have been trained to become excellent athletes and are very good at that. But the minute you suggest something political or out of the ordinary, that's when the fear factor kicks in. And these are people, a lot of individuals would assume, are beyond fear.
Well, you know, it's actually, it's funny about that. We were talking, when I was working on this book, one of the questions that we had, or that was asked of me by the editors, or by my editor, was, well, why aren't these players doing more? They can't be touched. You can't touch LeBron James. You can't touch Kobe Bryant. You can't touch these guys. You can't touch Kevin Durant. They're super rich, so they don't have any financial fear. You read Dr. Carlos's book, he was working as a security guard at a nightclub, and you said people would recognize you. Hey, isn't that John Carlos?
Right.
And they said, what are you doing here? And you would say,
what are you doing with this kind of job?
Exactly.
And you know, of course, my answer was, man, I got to do what I got to do to support my family.
Right? So if you're Kevin Durant, or if you're LeBron James makes $34 million a year. When LeBron James was 18 years old, before he scored a single point in the NBA, before he played a single game, he had a $90 million sneaker deal with Nike. That gives you a little bit of power. It gives you and should give you a lot of courage. A
lot of incentive, too.
And a lot of incentive, too. So there was this battle about fear. And what do you have to lose? Or do we have everything to lose? And one of the things that I didn't do as good a job of in this book, and I wish that I'd had, was to talk about the difference between men and women in the book. We talk about, people say to me, okay, where are the women in this heritage? And I was like, let's talk about that. And one of the things is that women don't make money in the team sports the way the men do. The average male salary in the NBA is $6 million a year. The average woman in the WNBA makes $60,000. And so I went to go talk to Martina Navratilova about this. We were at Wimbledon a couple years ago, and I was conceptualizing this project, and I said, we had seen what Maya Moore did, and we saw what the Minnesota Lynx did when the players, because you know, no white men, with the exception of Chris Long, very few white players get involved in this, but the women all stuck together.
Yeah.
And so I'd said to her, and I'd talked to Mary Carillo about this, and I said, Mary, why? Why are the women better at this? Why are they doing this better than the men? And she said, because we had nothing to lose. They already took everything. And she was talking about the great moment when the WTA was formed, when Billie Jean King was there in 1973, when they were going to unionize. And all the, you know, some of the women players were like, if we do this, you know, they're going to kill us. We're done. We're finished. We can't do anything. You know, we're going to lose. If we do this, we're going to lose everything. And of course, the way Mary, love Mary, you know, Mary comes up, and Billie Jean stepped in and won the room by saying, you have nothing to lose. You literally have nothing to lose.
It's like Sam Greenlee says in The Spook Who Sat by the Door, if you sleep on the floor, you can't fall out of bed. You know, one of the things I think that's interesting also, as we talk about this, you know, in a sort of broader historical context, even if we go back to 68 Mexico City, one of the things that always got me, you know, when I grew up in the 70s, sports was right in the aftermath of what you had done. And so it was inherently political. That's, to me, I didn't know that there was a time when it wasn't. But I think about two things. One, at the same Olympics in Mexico City, and nobody talks about this anymore, George Foreman reaches into his trunks and pulls out an American flag and twirls the flag around after you had raised the clenched fist. But the other thing I think about is OJ.
That's two different entities now.
Right. I got it. But I'm going somewhere with this.
Okay.
I got it. Because the same generation that you are a part of, OJ was part of that same generation as well. And so we've always had something that transcended the monolithic. It was never just one thing. At the height of activism and protest and consciousness and politics, OJ becomes arguably one of, if not the most popular athlete of that time, with the exception of Muhammad Ali. And OJ's narrative, of course, is, I'm not black, I'm OJ. And so the line you can draw from OJ to Republicans by sneakers, too, different generation, different
and
group of people.
I'm not black, I'm Kablan Asian.
Ah, there you go.
It keeps going. And also
the wood.
And also the Madison.
He looked real Kablan Asian in the mugshot.
Yeah, exactly, right? And
he looked real Kablan Asian.
And also that's an interesting thing. This lineage goes to today, 20 years after Tiger says that, you've got Madison Keys, who was the first African-American woman since Serena and Venus to make the top 10. And she's biracial, and her response when someone asked her, how did it feel to be the first black woman since the Williams sisters to make the top 10? And she said, well, I'm not black or white, I'm just Maddie.
Right.
And so when you go from there to here,
right,
you can see where this is going. And what I was going to say, I lost my track about female athletes. They're individual athletes. They work for it. It's an individual sport. So when you join this heritage and when you take a risk, they're going after your endorsements immediately. Mm-hmm. They're going to bankrupt you. And the players know that. And the women know that. And so they've got an even more difficult road, as usual. The women have it more difficult than the men.
Exactly.
They're just addicted to the money. I mean, I look at it like this. Like you stated, man, they come in with nothing. And if you're in the league for 2-3 years, I don't care whether it's the NBA or the WNBA, 3 times 60,000 is more money than you was anticipating getting in your life, okay?
Right.
Now, if a guy goes in the NBA or the NFL and he pulls down $10, $20 million, and I put them parallel with this woman called Oprah Winfrey, My question is, like I asked OJ, I said, man, how many millions of dollars do you have to have in your bank account for you to be a man? Okay? And then I asked Oprah Winfrey the same thing. Indirectly, I asked her, how many millions or billions do you have before you can step up and feel good and proud about being a black woman? See, because OJ and Oprah Winfrey, from my perspective, are those individuals that you talked about earlier that's wearing the T-shirt. Hands up. But that's a front. I just want you to think I'm athletic. That's why I wear Nike or an Adidas sweatsuit. That you think I'm a tennis player. Or I'm a track guy. But I'm a fake, is what I am. See, and I look at the individuals, Oprah, and I applaud the fact that she helped the kids in South Africa, the girls there. But I'm sure she had to cross over 10 million black girls here to get over to South Africa that need help right here. And these are the issues that I'm concerned about in terms of when are we going to wake up and start to help ourselves. Now, you're like, I look at a guy like Peter Norman. And, you know, a lot of people sit back and say, well, Peter Norman, man, he's the other guy. I didn't erase Peter Norman out of the equation. The media in America erased him out of the equation. They cut him out the portrait.
Right.
They stopped talking about him. They rained on Peter Norman in South Africa as heavy as they rained on me. And then you sit back and you have to really step back. Let me take a broader look at this picture. And you think, I said, well, let me Peter Norman. Let me equate Peter Norman with somebody else in history. And all I could do was come up with Frederick Douglass and John Brown. I said, now John Brown was Frederick Douglass' man. He gave his life for Frederick Douglass and the abolitionists. But why did they erase Frederick Douglass out of history the same way they did Peter Norman? And then let's go to modern day football right now. You think about, we have Kaepernick take a knee. We have a lot of black individuals say, I support you. I'm going to put the fist to the sky. I'm going to take a knee. But yet and still, we had white athletes out there that took a knee as well as put their hand on their shoulder and let them know, I got your back. But they erased Peter Norman out the picture. They erased John Brown out of the picture. And now they erased all the white football players out of the picture. And they erased them to tell white folks that, hey, man, that's none of your business. You stay out of it. They're telling you the same thing that they tell the athletes. Man, shut up and just play. Like you have no concern about what's happening in society just based on your pigmentation. You're a human being. When you go on the ground, they don't look and say, oh, he's white or he's black. They say he's dead. Okay? But the question is, once again, when are you going to step up? When are you going to go home and tell your neighbor something that you should have told your neighbor a long time ago about racist attitudes that I see taking place?
Well, Chris.
And let me just say, I learned something early about racism. I remember I was having my first kid, and my wife told me, she said, baby, you need to go to the store and get some milk. And I walked across the street to the store, and I saw these three white kids knock one white kid down, the fourth one. And they start kicking on him and stomping on him. And I looked at him, and I was just like, I don't like bullies. So I grabbed him and started throwing him off and pulling him off. And I anticipate I'm going to have some rhetoric from them. They didn't say anything. The guy that was on the ground that was getting his foot, their foot stuck in his nose, he looked at me and said, nigga, why don't you mind your own business? Now, this is the guy that was getting busted up. He looks at me and tells me, he said, nigga, mind your own business. And when he said that, I almost like came inside out. I didn't know how to respond to it. You see, you got to remember racism is a disease. And it ain't going to go away until you put it away. And it ain't no easy job. It ain't going to happen in a year. It ain't going to happen in 10 years or 50 years or 100 years. But we damn well got to get started to try and erase this. Because remember what your life is. When you came in this world, you thought it was about you until you saw little Johnny smiling. And then you realize that it ain't about me. What I'm here for is to make sure that my kids have a decent shot in life. I go to work, I work for my kids. I cook dinner, I cook for my kids. I bring furniture for my kids. Everything is for my kids. But you still, you will sit back and say, I'll get my kids the material things, but the moral fiber of this society, you're not concerned about building this in your kids and in your communities? Don't look at me as being no hero. Look in the mirror and ask yourself, who am I? What am I doing? He writes a book. He ain't writing the book because he's trying to get fat. He want a big fat bank account. It'd help. But I don't think that's why he wrote the book. He wrote the book to enlighten people. Just like I said, I'm not here for applause. I'm here to make the connection. Well, one person get out and say, man, I fully understand. I know that person is going to attract 10 more people that he's going to make that connection with too. I can't turn it around by myself, even by the fact that I reached maybe 50 million people in 1968, October 16th. But remember what I said, 50 years, a snail has moved farther along the lines of equality than we have in this society in which we live right now. And it's because I'm out here by myself trying to do it. The three of us are trying to do it. But we need numbers. And when you're doing something, it ain't about right or wrong. It ain't about rich or poor, fat or skinny. It's about getting off your butt and say, man, I want to fight to give my kids the decent opportunity. I want my kid to have friends that's loyal to them, regardless of what they color are. Little kids are born into this world. They don't know nothing about no racism. Let's just go play. And then someone instills racism somewhere along the way. Because I know that for a fact, because when I went to school in New York, I had white kids that were my stomp-down partners. And then one day, Louis came to me, he said, John, I can't hang with you. I said, what are you talking about, you can't hang with me? Well, my father told me we're getting ready to graduate, and I got to break my association with you. I said, well, what do you mean your father told you that? Well, what did you think? He said, my father said, if I associate with you, I won't be able to get a decent job in America. So we got to stop this. Time out.
I think at this time we are going to take some questions from the audience.
Get that guy. Get that guy. Right? Get that guy.
Oh, no, is there a... No, we got a system here. There's a system in place, I think.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
So thank you for this, each of you. No applause, Dr. Carlos, but in our heads, we are cheering for y'all wildly. So thank you. My question is about the current prohibition of the NFL against kneeling during the anthem. My question is, what advice would you give to athletes who still want to protest?
You want to take that?
Well, I think the NFL is trying to have it both ways, as they normally do. As Howard mentioned, the NFL is a for-profit business, so they don't know anything about activism or domestic violence or any of the issues that they find themselves trying to manage, which is why they manage them so poorly. But this idea that you can stay back in the locker room and do whatever you want, but if you come out on the field, you can't protest. Now, I would imagine that they're a group of people who you say to them they can't do something, they're going to do it because you told them not to. So I'm looking forward to see how this will play out. The other thing, which I think ties into Howard's book, is prior to very recently, NFL teams were in the locker room during the playing of the national anthem. The military went to the NFL and asked them if they would have the players out on the field during the anthem so that they could use this for recruiting. So this is a marketing situation.
Yeah, I was going to say the military paid the NFL.
That's right.
Right.
Money. They paid
tax. Right.
Well, not just the NFL. They paid all the sports. The Milwaukee Brewers charged the Wisconsin National Guard $49,000 to sing God Bless America. And it permeates all the sports. And what's fascinating about this is that we're at this moment in time right now when you are looking and you ask the question about what advice do you give the players? Well, the first thing the players have to do is they have to unite. They got to stick together. Because what these players did last season to me was a disgrace. I think that all these players should be ashamed of themselves, and I fight with them all the time over this. But the bottom line is that they're all multimillionaires, and when they stick together, they've got incredible resources. And yet they went into business with the owners to make this $90 million partnership while the NFL was blackballing Colin Kaepernick. So they went into business with the people who were blackballing one of their own.
Let me ask you a question. How long league has been in existence now? How long has the league been in existence?
1920.
So it took Colin Kaepernick to get on his knee for the NFL to jump up and say, we're going to give you $97 million to help you with your social issues. That's ironic. Then you sit back and you think to yourself today, you say about what you was talking about earlier. You sit back and think about these individuals that made these statements out there about you shouldn't be allowed to come out and you should stay in the locker room. Or what is a protest? A protest is like that beacon where you want people on the other side of the globe to see this particular protest.
That's right.
What protest are you going to see when they stay in the locker room? Oh, the press can say, oh, well, they got bad food and they was all in the restroom. They can say anything about why you didn't come out there other than the fact that you didn't go out there because of X, Y, Z. A protest is something that's supposed to be public, not private. That's the difference in what's my man named that was the owner of the Clippers?
Oh, Donald Sterling.
Sterling. No, not the Sterling. He wasn't the owner of the Clippers.
Yes, he was.
Was it Sterling?
Yeah.
I'm getting confused with Silver. Anyway, but you sit back and you think about Mr. Sterling. Now, my attitude about professional ownership, they get in the same room and they talk the same way. They have their prejudiced views, and they're behind the door, on the private side of the door. Mr. Sterling got out and said something that they say on the private side, and he just, by chance, made a mistake and said it on the public side. So everybody got in the uproar. And then the owners of the Clippers went to him, or the league went to him and told him, say, hey, man, you know, you're going to have to sell the team. And he said, what are you talking about? That statement that you made, you're going to have to sell the team. I'm not selling the team. What do you mean not selling the team? We all make that statement. Say, yes, but you did it on the public side. Now, we're going to give you a nice offer. The Clippers wasn't worth $400 million. They gave that man $2 billion.
That's right.
Because they knew that if they didn't get him out of the league, the NFL, or not the NFL, but the NBA would shut down.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because the players, we talk about power. You talk about what's going to happen next and what is revolution with these players. Do they have what it takes? And we all remember that the Clippers turned their jerseys inside out and they threw them in at half court. Well, Carmelo Anthony, who was playing for the Knicks at the time, so he didn't have a say because his team didn't make the playoffs, but he was talking about how we missed an opportunity right there.
That's right.
We should have shut the league down right there to send the message. And if I had been, well, if your team had made the playoffs, he says, well, I wouldn't have played. He says, we would not have taken the court. And so this goes back to this whole notion of player power. Well, what are they going to do with the power they have? We've seen it with the players trying to unionize in college. We've seen it with the University of Missouri when they shut down and they got the president and the chancellor of the university system to leave. The players have enormous power. What are they going to do with it?
Particularly in groups.
Yeah.
Let's move to the next question. We have a question here.
Oh, don't give him the mic.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlos and Mr. Howard, for coming here and sharing your views with us. John, I wanted to ask you, because, you know, I was a track athlete, you were a track athlete, and I noticed in history, track and field has been the political sport that has brought black people to the forefront. Paul Robeson was a great athlete, a track runner. Jesse Owens was a great runner, track runner, and they
Dick
made
Gregory. Dick Gregory.
They made political statements. You and Tommy made political statements, and Peter Norman in the Olympic Games. What I'm concerned about is the biggest sport that athletes, black athletes in high school and college participated in the 1960s was track and field. I noticed today that you don't see anything in the papers about track and field anymore. It's the number one sport that black athletes participate in, but none of the sports writers are writing about it. None of the newspapers cover it. The television, they don't cover it. And I'm just concerned about that. And I want to know how you feel about that.
Well, first of all,
and what's the reason for that?
Track and field, first of all, was the catalyst to provocation. Conflict. You understand? Track and field brought it about. And the powers to be felt that we have to disorganize track and field. We have to take those scholarships back. We have to, if you sit back and think about from 1968 to the current day, just go back and check out how many universities and colleges and high schools across this nation that disband their track programs. Total. Because they feel like these track guys is out of control. We don't know how to control them. We don't know how they might act in a world competition. You know, like, for instance, they came back for 50 years, and they're still doing it today. 50 years, they told all the people out there that they took our medals away. Yeah, we took John Carlos, we took Tommy Smith's medals from them. Propaganda, lies. Why'd they lie? They lied to intimidate any young individual that might think, I don't want them blinders on my eyes. I want to be able to think for myself.
I've seen that with Kaepernick.
Because they've trained us to go for the goal. Don't think about nothing else but go for the goal. Like they say, man, don't think about it. You're a jock. Just do what you do on the track. So they told all these young individuals, we took their medals away. Now, mind you, they trained us from the time we was knee-high to a grasshopper. It's the greatest thing in the world to go to the Olympic Games, which it is. It's the greatest thing in the world to represent your country, which it is. But my question is, when is my country going to represent me? That's my concern. And they don't want young individuals to even begin to think like I think. So they say, hey, man, if you step out the circle, we're going to take that medal away from
you.
Well,
and you have an enormous amount of power. Once again, when you start thinking about this, does anyone know who Don Yee is? Don Yee is Tom Brady's agent. And this is a very big issue for him. And he's like, look, the players could shut down every sport tomorrow if they wanted to. Because there's no game without them. And they know it, and Carmelo and I talked about this, and his point was, yeah, but their billions beat our millions. And if we really took advantage of this, we could win. But there are too many of us who are very comfortable getting a $10 million paycheck. Why risk that?
Two more questions. Two more. Stand up.
Yeah, we talk too much.
We'll do one over here.
We just talk too much.
Griffone, the question is going to be right here.
Hi, I'm sorry. I'd like to find out why is it that I hear on radio talk shows, ESPN shows, tons of athletes or commentators telling young individuals that it's okay to take that salary and forego the education. Education is so important, and it's like nothing. Go ahead and sign. We have a bunch of freshmen or sophomores going to the NBA this coming week. They have no idea what to do with the millions of dollars that they are going to inherit and how to hire a lawyer, how to hire an agent. Why is it that none of the reporters will stand up and say, stay in school and get your education?
Well, for a couple of reasons.
First of all, it's deeper than just the sportscasters. It's a thing called in-house training. A lot of the parents that have these kids, pushing more into college, they don't know the university system themselves. They can't teach their kids what they don't know. Then you sit back and you say, well, who's representing them? No one from your environment, no one from your culture is representing them as an agent. So they get in there. You ain't never had $5 in your pocket, now you got $500 million. What do I know to do, man? Let me just go out and spend until I can't spend no more. Many black athletes have become millionaires and become bums in the street, all in the same circle. Based on what you're talking about. But it don't just go with the newscasters, man. That's something that has to start in the household. So we got to educate our parents as well.
All right, we have time for this last question right here.
Thank you very much for the three of you. It's really an honor to hear you and see you. But my comment is this, something that you both raised, certainly you, Howard, and you, John, in particular, that it's two sides of the same coin. It's not just the athletes showing up, but it's the fans and patrons also boycotting the game. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the issue that me and a couple of my colleagues have been talking about for a while. At this moment, this very moment, this president is doing one of the most horrendous acts, separating children from their parents. We all know the story. What if, I'm going to put it to you, because some of my colleagues have been talking about this, if all the baseball teams, not just the two Houston teams, but all the baseball teams, whether it be the Dodgers here, the Yankees, the Chicago Sox, Cubs, we don't play any games tomorrow. I understand, and maybe, Howard, you know the numbers, 60-70% of the baseball players now are Latino, Latina, Afro-Latino. They're Puerto Rican, Cubano.
37.
Pardon?
37.
37%. Get the African-Americans, too. 7%. Get the Euro-Americans, too. Now we got nearly 100%. It's not just enough to wear the 42 Jackie Robinson. But if it's true, which we know, that the owners, the billionaire owners, can get to the president, get to the state legislatures to say no more games until you make a response. Could you respond to
that kind of
collective? And then the fans in the stands also. We're not going to buy a ticket to the football, basketball, baseball game. But back, be there back. Go ahead.
Well, you're making the assumption that they all think the same, and they don't. Right. I mean, you've got... One of the things that Major League Baseball went through, and I'll be very quick about this, and I apologize, I hate when we do this, when people don't get to ask their questions. One of the things that happens is that last year, there was a contingent of Latino players who were just enraged about how the president treated the Puerto Rico situation. And the Houston Astros won the World Series. They beat the Dodgers in 7 games, as we know here. And there was this question about whether or not what the Latino players were going to do. I mean, Altuve, although he's from Puerto Rico, he's from Venezuela, but Carlos Correa, who's from Puerto Rico, were they going to go to the White House? What were they going to do? And Major League Baseball pressured them to go. Your business, your job is pressuring you to do this because they don't want this optic. We had this issue years ago. It was in 2008 with the Arizona immigration bill. And you've got half the league in spring training down in Arizona. None of the Latino players stood up. Because they teach the Latino players to be grateful. You're here in the United States. You were making $2 a week stitching basketballs at a factory. And now you make $100 million. And so one of the things that the Players Association, the union, really tries to do is they're trying to get a lot of the foreign players, especially the Latino players in the Dominican Republic, because they have so much power. They are the game. They're the economic engine. To try to get them to think in terms of their self-worth and not view themselves as being grateful. You don't have to be grateful. You can be thankful, but you don't have to be grateful. Your talent brought you here. But a lot of the players don't view it that way. They see the fear, and they don't want to go back. And the other thing that we didn't even get a chance to talk about, and you know this, John, Dr. Todd, you know this as well, is the number of people who are relying on you. You are the economic engine of your entire family, not just your brothers and sisters, but the entire generation. Mm-hmm. You pay for everybody. And Pedro Martinez in Santo Domingo, how many schools and churches he built? Just this one person. So the amount of pressure that those players feel, it's not that easy just to say, okay, let's go, we got a revolution. Number one, you don't have the numbers because baseball players are, you know, it's a very Republican sport. And why is that funny? It's true. But anyway, so there's that. You just don't, you know, what you really need is you need that group of players. You need that small, committed, growing number of players to use their power, like in football. You need the quarterbacks to say, you know what, we're not doing this. Because they can shut the game down, but I think that they don't have the education up here. They're not geared to think that way. They're geared to thinking that the way to go is to be team-oriented, when as Don Fehr, the great labor leader with the Major League Baseball Players Association, told me, the game is not Red Sox-Yankees. The game is owners versus players.
I think on that note, and to sort of echo something Dr. Carlos said earlier, it's all of us. We cannot expect athletes to do all of these activist things if the culture itself is not doing it. And what I keep thinking about as we close this out is the fact that there is a person sitting in the White House right now who did not get there by electing himself. He got there because a certain percentage of people in the right states, with a strong assist from the Russian government, put him in office, and many people sat by and watched it happen. So you have to apply these same standards across the board. They can't just be expectations placed upon athletes. We live in an anti-intellectual culture. The president is a perfect example of that, that you do not need to be highly educated to be successful in this society. So we can't hold athletes accountable, expect athletes to be accountable when we're not holding the rest of the society to these same standards of accountability. On that, we will close.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
All right. All right. All right.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors through the Los Angeles County Arts Commission and Errant Fox. Additional support is provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation donors. Media support is provided by KCRW 89.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.